Now we'll work with the way of cultivating a, we could call, a sense of flow with inner experience, with our own experience. And this is very much as taught historically by the Buddha through the model of the five skandhas or aggregates, which was his way of saying that you can look at the constituents of experience. You can be with all the constituents of experience without a sense of self. And so the instructions are very simple. And we'll go through one at a time several of the constituents of experience. This is very similar to what we do with our mindfulness practice. So first, be aware of the sensations of the body. And just stay with the sensations of the body, and then notice if your mind gets distracted or if there's any sign of what we've called a thick self. Again, any reactivity, any self-centered thinking, any sense of I like this, I don't like this, any self-image, and so forth. Just to be with mindfulness of the sensations of the body, however you experience those. And if you find it helpful, you can either be with the sensations of the whole body, or if it works, may work more easily for you, you can be aware of a part of the body. Maybe you're aware just of the sensations, maybe of the hands coming together, or maybe even of the breath. So you can have a more narrow focus on the sensations of the body, or a wider focus. That's up to you. You might want to try both. Now, the first area that's identified in the traditional model is called form. We could talk about that as related to the body. Also could be external form. So our practice here, we could be with sensations and notice if we can be just with the flow of sensations or whether there is a thick sense of self that appears. And if there is, we just notice that. We can be mindful of what that's like. Again, could be thoughts, could be reaction, and so forth. The second area is that of the sense of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So what's being identified are the different constituents of experience. So there's also that sense of something being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. We looked at that yesterday, and one of the keys for this practice is to be able to be with the pleasant or the unpleasant without going to aversion or wanting or to reactivity. Can I be with this being pleasant or this being unpleasant? So again, the invitation here would be to just be, we can be with the sensations of the body, but particularly notice what feels pleasant, what feels unpleasant. The idea is that every moment of an experience has some quality of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. A lot is in the neutral area. So here, just maybe be with the way you were being attentive to the body. It could be with the hands or the whole body. And just notice, is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it neutral? For me, I'm noticing the contact of my hands. Seems to be a little bit unpleasant, a little warm, a little bit of pressure, and I can just be with that. Again, I want to be with that and notice then if there's any sense of I, any reactivity. And the intention is to be with the flow of experience of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and just, as it were, let it happen. And as we continue, the third area identified is perception. And here the practice is just to be, particularly with external objects, and let them appear as much as possible without a thick sense of self. So here I'll just ask you to let your eyes open if they were closed, and just let the different objects come to your visual field and let them appear and notice if there's any thick sense of self appearing. It may not be, but just to notice, again, any sense of reactivity, liking or disliking, self-consciousness, self-image, self-centered thinking. We'll just do this for maybe 3 minutes or so. And with your eyes, you can have the sense of having, we sometimes say, soft eyes, so they're receptive. Now just take a look, if you haven't already, at perhaps your own clothes or something nearby that in a sense is yours. Continue with the same practice, but notice if there is a sense of self arising, starting to have a thick self with one of your possessions. And now we'll move to the fourth area in the traditional model. This is, in the traditional model, it's called sankhara. It really refers, we would say, to thoughts and emotions. So here I think I'd suggest that you be with the breath or whatever your primary object is. Be with it in a kind of a light way, and just notice when thoughts come, and see if you can again let them come without too much sense of self. And then notice when your mind gets, when the thoughts come and there's just what I was calling self-centered thinking, or a sense of liking or disliking or reactivity. So starting with the breath and noticing thoughts and noticing emotions if they are there. And now be aware of all of what we've just had room for. Be aware of whatever occurs in the flow of experience. And see if you can have a sense of just a flow of whatever appears. Now a thought, now a sensation, now a sound. We sometimes call this choiceless awareness. Letting your mindfulness be there as if you are sitting with a river in front of you. And the river has things coming down the river. You just pay attention to whatever is in the river right in front of you. Sometimes there's, in the river, there's a branch or something else coming down. Some leaves, maybe a plastic bottle. So you just notice what comes before you in this river of experience. So in a similar way, you sit and you may notice thought, sensation, sound. Notice if you can be with that sense of an ongoing flow of experience, and then also notice when something like a thick self appears. Again, reactivity, self-centered thinking, a sense of I like this, I don't like this, self-consciousness, self-image. So be with the flow and notice when a sense of self appears. Now continue being aware of the flow of different phenomena. Again, sometimes the sound will be predominant for you, sometimes a sensation, sometimes a thought will come, might be several thoughts. Stay with that sense of the flow of phenomena. One thing after another, like objects coming down a river. And be aware that in the background there is consciousness or awareness. There is consciousness or awareness, which is knowing the phenomena. The phenomena are in the foreground, the awareness is in the background. And now let the consciousness or awareness be in the foreground with the phenomena going to the background. So be aware of consciousness or awareness right now. This is the fifth of the areas identified by the Buddha. Be aware of the consciousness as the foreground with the phenomena that are occurring as background. And for some of us, it can help to open the eyes, actually. Let the phenomena appear, and then shift the from the phenomena as foreground to awareness as foreground. So awareness is like the receptacle in which all phenomena occur. And again, notice if anything gets in the way of just that awareness of the consciousness, any sense of a fixed self. Again, could be simply self-centered thinking, reactivity, and so forth. This is a quotation, actually, from the Buddha, I think, about this kind of practice. He says, "Well then, this is how the training should be done. Concerning this body, with its consciousness, let there be no self-centered imaginings of I and mine, and no such bias. With regard to external objects, let there be no self-centered imaginings of mine, and no such bias. We shall then abide in the attainment of the heart's liberation and the liberation by wisdom." For most people, it takes more than one session. But what we just did, I hope anyone a little sleepy, it can happen, it's okay. But that kind of practice, a very simple practice, but it's a very fundamental practice for exploring anatta. Again, simple in that we learn to be with the constituents of experience without adding the sense of self, I, and mine. Again, a lot of us may do this in other ways. Again, can be with the sunset and just be with the phenomena. And you know, if you notice thinking, you say, "Okay, not now," right, or something like that. Or maybe you're listening to a friend. Maybe a friend is in distress, and you're listening, and you notice that you're thinking about lunch, and you just say, "Okay, I don't need that now. I just want to listen, right? I want to listen fully." And it's no different, really. These would be the ordinary ways of practicing. So it's to really, but the meditative training would be something like what we just did. It would be to train just, it could just be with the sensations of the breath. See if you can be just on the level of sensation, and then notice when something like a thick sense of self appears. Not that the thick sense of self is bad, we're just noticing it. We're just noticing it and being with it. And to some extent, concentration can help. When we have the mind that can really be present without distraction, this will help us to do this practice. But this is a kind of practice that we could repeat, you know, and have it be a main practice for a year, right? And after a year, there'd be a lot of learning, right? Or you could do this kind of practice if you do a residential retreat. You could focus on this practice most of the time. I've sometimes spent a month just doing something like this practice, right? And again, when there's good concentration, there often can be, you know, hours and hours and hours with almost no sense of self, just being with the phenomena. It changes one's perception in life because you realize it's possible to be with the phenomena without so much sense of thinking and self and so forth. And it also teaches you something very much about the deeper nature of the mind, right? But the beginning point is something just very much like this practice. We try to be with the flow of phenomena, and then we track where we're not. It's as simple as that. It's not so different from what we do just in being with the breath, right? That's so different. You know, we're with the breath, you notice what comes up, you give it a label, thinking, planning, and then you go back to the breath. And so all of this is making it possible for us to be with what is occurring with a very thin sense of self or no sense of self. Yeah. And this would be how we train in this third area. And we can also begin to see how the three areas are connected. Impermanence, dukkha, and not-self or anatta. That when you can be with the flow without much sense of self, you see that often when there's a thick sense of self, it's very connected with reactivity. Very often, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Anyone notice that? Yeah, so you're sitting there, and maybe something says, you know, "I like impermanence better. I don't like this. When's it going to end?" Right? And maybe that happens. And you can see how reactivity is connected with that sense of self, right? And how as we can be with the flow without a sense of self so much, it's very much like an impermanent flow, right? Everything is arising and passing, right? And again, when we look to the question about the self, and there are a lot of complications. I want to admit that, and there, you know, there's one of the quotations I put in this four-page handout is from a American monk named Thanissara Bhikkhu. Probably some of you know his work, and he is in the Thai forest tradition, and he says that it's not a question of simply getting rid of the self. Right? He says some uses of the self are helpful, like to try to act ethically. You often need a sense of self as responsible. Well, that's useful, right? But it's a question of what's useful and skillful, and then at certain points, you'd let go of that. So this is the quotation from him about that. The issue is not what is my true self, but rather what kind of perception of self is skillful, or what kind of use of self is skillful, and when is it skillful, and what kind of perception or use of self is of not self is skillful, and when is it skillful. He says a sense of self is an important part of practice, especially a sense of self that encourages responsibility, mindfulness, and care. Sometimes you have to do one thing at one stage and then later turn around and erase it. The path to the unconditioned is conditioned, in the Buddhist terminology. It is fabricated. In the attainment of awakening, you put aside both self and not self. So you train in a certain way, and when you get to a certain point, it's irrelevant. Right? So then I feel some relief about that. So I find that very helpful. So sometimes we say, get rid of the self, no self, right? But for some things, it's useful. Moral responsibility, you know, can be very helpful, or a sense of commitment to one's practice. You might have a sense of self, and there it's useful. It can be a problem, like in Avram's questions, we can, you know, get, you know, have a sense of self related to practice that's not so helpful, right? That's true, but sometimes it can be helpful. So I find that
certain jobs require certain self.
Yeah, certain parts of the practice require a sense of self, like being ethical. You think, oh, did I do that right? Maybe that's useful, right? And then at a certain point, that's not useful. And so, you know, this is where maybe you need a community and teachers to say, all right, you're very good with the ethics, but okay, now it's a little bit heavy. And then you say, okay, I want you to, because basically what happens is it's like a little bit like learning to ride a bike. And when you're in training, you need what we call in U.S. training wheels. You have that right for kids, right? You need training wheels. At a certain point, if you were 15 years old and still using training wheels, that's a problem, right? Or it could be a problem. And so then you let go of the training wheels. Self is sort of like that. It's like you need it in certain parts of the training, and then certain parts of the training, it can be a problem. And then if you just ask the question, is a self good or bad? And then you're going to get confused, right? Because sometimes it's useful, sometimes it's not. So, any observations from the practice? Let's save the larger questions till a little later. But just observations: am I doing the practice correctly? What happened? It's pretty simple. You just try to be with the flow of phenomena, and then notice what gets in the way, right? That's it. And again, you know, what I'll talk about later in the afternoon is how we bring this home. So again, you could do of these three types of practice, you could do just one of them, and maybe you do it for half of your sitting meditation every day. Maybe you do the breath, you just get a little bit more stable, you do some simple mindfulness, and then maybe the last half you do practice with impermanence. You do that for 1 month, you'll learn a lot, you know, and it'll make it your own. Or same thing, dukkha is just very helpful for daily life. That's probably the, or looking for the thick self, because they're very connected, right? You could make this part of your everyday meditation. You do it for a week or a month, and then it gets internalized. So just any questions, am I doing the practice right? This happened. Yeah.
I'm still confused about the impermanence.
Yeah.
But I do feel this a lot of times, especially when I'm doing the...
A lot of time when I'm doing the breathing,
that I have something that annoys me, like suddenly I'm really, really aching, or, you know,
yeah.
In daily life I will never notice, but suddenly I...
Itching, yeah.
And then I feel the impermanent, because if I notice it and then I try to breathe and suddenly it's gone.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to not to attempt to, you know.
Yeah.
So this is the only thing I can think about the impermanent during the meditation, but otherwise I don't really understand it. Other examples.
Yeah. Remember that it has a few different aspects. Partly, and we'll do, this afternoon, we'll do a short reflection on what I'd call gross impermanence, sort of on just that's more ordinary thinking about things change, you know. You know, we get old and so forth, things change, governments change, the seasons come and so forth. We'll do that later. So here, there are a few aspects and for the working with impermanence in meditation. One of them would just be to try to notice when something begins, when it stays, and when it ends.
Like with the itching.
You know, sometimes we don't notice something till after it's begun. But try to get a sense of sometimes you can get a sense of a beginning. But maybe here you don't. You just notice it's there.
Suddenly
it's there. Then you can focus on how it's changing. And this is important, because often with something like itching, when it's a problem, we just think of it as one thing. We have a concept, itching, you know? And we actually are not seeing how it's actually continually changing.
Yes.
Right, and so that's one thing we can do. We can say, oh, it's itching, so it's now it's here, now it's here, now it's intense. I just watched it change for 30 seconds. Oh, now it's not there anymore.
Yeah.
Interesting, you know. So we can watch change and how it's actually different. It's not one thing. The mind thinks it's one thing. That's when we get reactive, right? But if you have, so one way, again, one way of working with it is to notice how something changes. We can do that with the breath. Okay, it's soft, it's strong, whatever. So we can work with change, and then very helpful to notice when something ends or when something leaves, like when the itching ends.
Beside the itching, I don't get other examples, because breathing is like something that I control more, so I can do it like, I don't see, I can control if it's permanent or not permanent, but the itching is a good example for me, because like you said, I can feel it or I can hear something. I don't control it, I just hear it and I see how it changed.
Yeah.
So beside this example of itching, what more can I...
Well, I would train with what we did yesterday, that basically with the different senses. Mm. You know, so you could work with sound. And you could even, I don't know, put on some simple music and just notice how things are changing. What we're doing is really, this is a kind of training. Or you can go, you know, outside where there are a lot of sounds. Go sit on a busy street and just listen to the sounds and watch them change, watch them come, watch them go, watch them change. hear a car comes by, you don't so much think about the car, but you listen to the sounds, and it changes, right? So it's really staying, that would be one way, staying with the sounds. You could stay with sensations, either, like I was saying, either in a particular part of the body, you could stay with the breath, you could stay with the sensations maybe of your legs, you could stay with sensations of the upper body, you could stay with the whole body, and you just notice how something arises. Like if I sit right now, just notice where your attention goes to. Like I notice there's sensation right here. And I can feel my breath, there's movement, things are changing. It's the rhythm of my breathing. I can also feel a little bit of heat, you know, and so you just notice what's there and notice how it shifts. So you can do it with basically the different senses. You could do it with taste, like with a meal, smell. You can do it with, if your mind is quiet, you can just sit and say, let me just be aware of thoughts coming and going. And I can sit here now. And I have a thought, someone just came in the door. You know, and I have the thought, oh, I'm glad she came. You know, I just noticed the thoughts. Now I sit. I thought, oh, there is Renee. Okay, just ordinary thoughts. So you just watch them come, and then maybe I think, I'm not thinking this, but maybe I think, what do I do tomorrow? Oh, and then sometimes, of course, with thinking, the thinking will take you away for 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. So the thinking is, we said yesterday, is harder. And it's possible when the mind is quiet, just to have the thoughts, they just come. In fact, when the mind is very quiet, it's very interesting, when the mind is very, very quiet, you can notice thoughts just like a burp. They go, whoop, a burp, like, ah. You know, and you can notice the thoughts are just like a little whoop. And when the mind, maybe some of you experience this on retreat, when the mind is quiet, when there's not much thinking going on, you notice just little whoop. And then I say, oh, that is a thought about finances. It's like it's a little seed.
It's like a soap bubble.
Yeah, it's a little, and this when the mind gets quiet, this is what, when you get to deeper into meditation, what's so fascinating, because you can watch the whole construction of the mind. And what I'm saying there is just like, that's a little bubble. I know that if my mind was less quiet or if I let it grow, that would be a 3-minute discussion of finances, right? But as it was, it's just, whoop, it's gone, right? It's very interesting. And again, when you can be at that level, you can see, you can get a sense of how ordinary experience is constructed. Just out of nothing. Yeah? Yeah?
So the technique you just demonstrated, I learned how to work with negative emotions.
So yeah.
It's usually throat, chest, and solar plexus.
Yeah.
And what I was taught was to literally disengage from the story, which is the thoughts.
Yeah.
And then just follow around as it moves along, like it's changing.
That's right.
Stopping. And then it's actually painful because you feel those.
You feel some of the.
But it has a really healing.
Can be very helpful, and maybe again, some of you are psychologists, or one of the areas that I studied was the Hakomi method of body-based psychotherapy. Does anyone know that? Yeah, several of you. It's very helpful. In fact, I studied some with several people from Israel at the time. This was in San Francisco area, and one of them, I think, is in Tel Aviv, named, anyone know Karen Sarfati? Well, that's great. I have to meet her again because we studied together. But Hakomi uses techniques very much like that. You use mindfulness, and it's very useful in psychotherapy when we have a culture that's very mental, right? Very mental, thinking a lot. And that in that kind of approach, you use access of the body as a way to go beneath the thinking, it often can get more quickly to what the issue is. Where if you think about it all the time, not so helpful, right? So it's kind of a critique of too much thinking in psychotherapy, partly. But then you would actually just, okay, they would say, okay, I feel lonely. Okay, where do you feel it in the body, right? Mm-hmm. You would actually go to the body and just be there. And often something would open up in another, like just like you're saying, in a different way.
It's amazing, the guy who said to surf the emotion.
What?
There's a guy in California who teaches surfing emotions, which means, I learned it from you.
Surfing?
Surfing emotion means
you
just find it in the body,
yeah,
and then you surf it.
Surf it. Okay.
Surf.
Okay.
And you stay on.
Yeah, yeah.
On the sensation.
Yes. So when you have the capability to more just to be with the body without too much thinking, because not everyone can do that so easily, right? If you're thinking too much, you can't do that. So that you have some training, and there are many uses for it. But did that get a sense more of the how to work? So we work, and you can just see which of the senses sort of work best for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other observations or particularly about the practice?
You gave me a fresh angle.
Yeah.
Because hearing sharing of yogis, I will use we because sometimes I'm inside this group,
When
we refer to thoughts as a bad thing, which
right.
means a failure. Some people said, I failed today during the meditation because I thought, and today, and we all heard about tagging and trains and blah, blah, blah. But I don't know, somehow today I didn't refer to the thoughts that popped as failure or as something negative.
Yeah. It's very important. Yeah, it's often a misunderstanding of meditation.
Yes.
Yeah, very common in the West. And when we say, we did this yesterday, when I say the West, that means Israel too, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you use that language like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Failure.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very important thing because the aim is not to have a quiet mind with no thoughts.
Yeah.
That is not the purpose. It's to be, basically, it's to be able in every moment to be free. That's it. Another way of saying that is to be responsive in every moment. So sometimes being responsive requires a lot of thinking, right? How can we deal with this situation, right? Mm-hmm. We need thinking. So I think it's maybe because there's so much thinking in Western culture that a lot of people recognize that. Like, one Thai teacher who I studied with, Chan Buddhadasa, he was asked, what do you think of Western civilization? Big question. And he said, lost in thought. And which is true, a lot of thinking. But, like one of my Tibetan teachers, Sokhi Rinpoche, he says, in the Tibetan communities, they can't think very well. they need to think better. They can do other things well, but not such good thinking. So he says, when I think of that Achan Buddhadasa, what do you think of Western civilization? Gandhi was also asked the same question. What do you think of Western civilization? And do you know what his answer was? It would be a good idea. Yeah. So, did you get that?
No.
No, okay. I need to explain? Okay. So, it's meaning that the ideas are nice, the realities are not so nice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, if they actually followed what they say, very good. Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense now?
Yeah.
Okay. So, any other... So that's very important, near, right? Yeah, that in this practice with not self, we just can let thoughts be there. And the problem is more when we get reactive or fix sense of self, right? And that, you know, the aim is to be able to use thoughts for skillful purposes. You know, and obviously all the teachings involve a lot of thinking, right? Or listening, right? Like what we're doing now. Mm-hmm. If we weren't thinking,
with feelings as well.
That's right.
It's not bad feeling, just getting
nothing
forward.
No part of the experience is a problem. Mm-hmm. But they're all there for certain purposes, right? Yeah, but yeah. So you had one. Yeah.
Yes.
It was Alona, right?
Alona.
Yeah.
I realized during this meditation that I was, struggling very hard to concentrate and to sense the phenomena, and eventually I just said, I don't care anymore. I kind of surrendered, and there was something clear now, and there was this motion of things moving, happening, thoughts and sounds. So somehow, sometimes just have to.
Yeah, that's related to Avram's point. There can be trying too hard, right?
I always try too hard.
Does anyone else try too hard? Raise your hand. Okay. Yeah. Try really hard not to try too hard.
That makes sense.
No, I didn't mean that. Right.
I think one of the main instructions.
It's a big thing, yeah.
When I learned, I'm not that experienced in meditation, but one of the main instructions, which is also related to what they said, is don't be such judgmental in your practice. Try also in the practice not to say, I felt I should focus in my breathing, I didn't do it.
Yeah.
Part of the practice is just accepting it and being judgmental.
And relaxing. Again, it's always a balance. It goes back to this question of what is skillful effort or use of energy. And sometimes it's skillful to put in more energy, and sometimes it's skillful to really relax and let things go. And you have to know, we have to know when to do one, when to do the other. And so here for you, and for most of us, if we have a background of trying too hard, mostly we have to just relax and do nothing. At a certain point, and then you really like that, and then you think, I have arrived.
But then you get sleepy, then you get
So it's always a balance, and some of you know, you're studying the seven factors of awakening, right? And it's interesting, they are organized into seven qualities, which both are expressions of being awakened, but they also help take you there, so to speak. And there is mindfulness, and then there are three qualities which give more energy.
The area.
Yeah, the inquiry and energy and joy or rapture, piti, right? And then there are three which are called stabilizing. Those are more, so there's the energizing and there's the stabilizing. And the last three are tranquility and concentration and equanimity. And it's interesting because when you're practicing, at certain times, it is not skillful to try to concentrate more or to try to have more tranquility because you may be kind of sleepy and that will just make you more sleepy. Mm-hmm. Right? And then sometimes when you're really kind of really restless or nervous, it's not so helpful sometimes to use the energizing qualities. Then you want to have more the stabilizing. So that's one way of talking about skillful effort. Yeah. It's interesting. So some of you are studying that, I know. You had an observation, then you had a question?
Or observation? Not a question. Like
observation?
About the trying hard.
Yeah.
I think in my experience that generally I know when I try hard.
Yeah.
But I don't stop it. It's
a habit.
It's not exactly a habit. There is a very reasons for the trying hard, and there are like roots that it's like I'm being played a bit by some attachments, some ideas that I should and stop trying hard means letting go of all those ideas that hold me, that cause me to try hard.
Yeah.
So that's why maybe I don't always stop. Sometimes I stop.
Yeah, so you sometimes try too hard, right? That's what you're saying?
Yeah.
Like you gain something from it. You gain something. You win
if
something.
If I would stop trying hard, I would have to let go of something.
Let go of something it might be...
I'm afraid to let go. Identity.
Yeah, we see that very clearly, like with school, right? Okay, I am a good student. I work hard. I try hard. I get rewarded. My parents love me. They give me gifts, right? And so they're, and it all is because I work hard. I try hard, right? And so as a child, I get that conditioning. And then as an adult, I think, oh, if I will succeed in life, get everything I want, I should just try hard. I am no different than when I was 8 years old and was a good student, right? So it's not so. It's often like that, isn't it? And so, but you're saying in the mind, we have what we call, in psychology or other work, we have a limiting belief. That's very unconscious, is also what you're saying. The unconscious belief is, I will get good things when I try hard. And if I don't try hard, I won't get good things, right? So we have that almost unconscious belief. And partly what we do in meditation is we like I think you're saying, you get to see that, right? You get to see, and it's not so easy, you know?
I mean, to stop trying hard, you need a lot of bravery.
Yeah.
It's going against what I'm used to.
Getting what you're used to and what you maybe have been rewarded for in the past, right?
Maybe.
Maybe not so much.
No, I mean that's like details that I don't know. Maybe.
Well, maybe, but as a child, right? Is it when did your parents teach you to try hard?
No, but I did it myself without them trying.
Without you doing it, well, yeah, okay.
It's true that a lot of it is just collective and even genetic.
Yeah.
Conditioning.
Very collective conditioning for many, like you were saying, you learned how to be late. Yeah, and we all have some version of that, and sometimes it's connected with trying, and this is really when we, there are a lot of complexities, but basically when we study the thick self, we start seeing this more, right? And, again, to investigate what you're talking about, there'd be many ways to do that, right? Meditation is one way, to see more. But there could be many ways, and each of us has something like that. Something like that conditioning. And like I was saying, there are many, many forms. We were saying it's kind of all the forms of conditioning to be a self or identity. It's a little bit endless, right? You have a personal self. You have self connected with your family, with your culture, with your own developmental history, with all sorts of things, with social conditioning, your membership in this particular group, in the culture, a lot, gender, all these things, yeah. So we're not studying that today. but it's helpful to know that that's part of it. But I think it's, in some of the things that are interesting to me, use of mindfulness and doing the kind of practices that we're doing actually, I think, is being used a lot to actually see more clearly into social conditioning. Because with mindfulness, you can start to see a pattern of the thick self, right? And when you have, I know some people I know are using this, for example, in the U.S. to look at race and conditioning around race, which, you know, it's, in the U.S. it's one of our major unworked out areas, I would say, after 400 years, right? That's still quite a way to go. But people are using mindfulness to see the conditioning more clearly, and when you, some of it, when you see it more clearly, it's you start to bring what was previously unconscious more to consciousness, yeah. And that's, it's part of it. That by itself is not adequate, but it's part of what is helpful. Yeah. Who else? We have maybe take one more.
Just really quick, just maybe yeah. This is not a real question, but sometimes I wonder, you know, Buddha being male, like, it's
yeah.
Different.
Yeah, me too.
You know, just because I, like, for me, feelings are so dominant, and,
yeah.
Or emotions.
And yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, with form, likes, dislikes, perception, thoughts, consciousness, are feelings, like, even underneath my rational mind that I discovered, the rational thinking that, you know, that overthinking is related to a lot of fear.
Yeah.
And so then I really, like you were saying, sitting with fear. Does that,
yeah.
Would one work with fear and, like, from the five areas of where does the work around just...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, first of all, yes, I think that... I was interested in giving you the traditional model, just partly to get a sense of it. I think that for us, with our conditioning, you know, we would modify it, if I can say, you know. And yeah, I think that there are aspects of the teachings of the Buddha which are reflect cultural conditioning, right? And we would, you know, I mean, the Buddha in terms of gender was somewhat of a revolutionary, right? Even though a little bit hesitant at times, you know. So some of you know the history, right? Some of you know the history. He at first thought he would not have women be brought into the order, but I think it was his, I forget who, Ananda, and I think his mother said, you should do this. And he said, okay. I might have that detail a little bit wrong, but basically people asked him and then he agreed, you know, which was at the time was extremely unusual. You know? And he also was, many of you know, in the community of monks and nuns, there was no caste as there was in India at that time and of course still now. So I think, so first of all, that's true, and I think we would see there are aspects of gender conditioning related to the traditional teachings, I think, or just the way it's expressed. I would say that personally. You know, in some of the details, you know, in some, like in the teaching about reactivity or impermanence, or what the way I talk about thick self, I don't think so much necessarily. In the aggregates, yeah, I think we would look at experience a little differently. In the Asian languages, there's not even any word that translates for emotion. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's very interesting, yeah. I mean, they have the word is citta, C-I-T-T-A, and it essentially includes both thoughts and emotions. They don't have a word. They don't. They divide up experience differently than, you know. You have. Is it?
But the
yeah.
Third foundational mindfulness is the
citta.
It's citta.
Citta.
Well, that relates to fears and hindrances and all that stuff.
Yeah, it does. But what I'm saying is that they obviously identify what we would call emotions, but they don't have any word like emotion. That's the point. So they don't have a category that is equivalent to emotion or feeling in that sense. So it's very interesting, right?
Because they don't separate it, or they don't separate it into two categories, or
yeah, it's complicated. Yeah, they don't separate. They, you know, they just have one concept that it would include thinking, mm-hmm. planning, and fear. Right? It's called citta, mm-hmm. right? It's it's different, right? I don't say it's better or worse, but it's different. And so here, there are kind of, Renee, there are two aspects, you know. Mostly here, we are looking today and yesterday more at how we can be mindful of emotions, of thoughts, and be with them without reactivity and so forth. There's tremendous, if we were to talk, how can I be skillful with difficult emotions, for example, that's a whole nother area, you know, that we could explore. And here we're not doing that. But so they're generally, you know, like in the teaching of the four foundations of mindfulness, some of you know, the first foundation is mindfulness of the body. The second foundation is mindfulness of feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. But very important, you know. We saw that's very important because when you're not aware of pleasant, it goes to grasping. That's why he emphasized that. That's why it appears. You know what? You know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, mindfulness of body, yeah, you would expect that. Mindfulness of thoughts and emotions, you would expect that. Mindfulness of the sense of pleasant, you wouldn't expect that. You know, that, what's the reason for that? Well, it's because when you're not aware of pleasant, you go to grasping, and when you're not aware of unpleasant, you go, into a reactivity. That's the idea. Okay, I'll just have one or two more thoughts, then we'll have walking meditation for a little while.
I had a very pleasant experience.
Oh, let me just finish the thought, though.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Yeah, I was just on the second foundation out of four. Okay.
Yeah.
And so the third foundation is mindfulness of citta, and we would say that's mindfulness of thoughts and emotions. Right? But when we're mindful, it's more receptive. We are letting the thought, we're not doing anything to the thoughts or emotions, we're just being mindful of them, right? And the fourth foundation is where you bring in the wisdom dimension and also being responsive. This is called mindfulness of dhammas, and so it's complicated, but what? Dhammas. I think I like to think of it as mindfulness of the process of experience. That's kind of ordinary English, but it's only there that you start really talking about what is a wise way to respond to this emotion. First three, just receptive. Yeah, that's kind of so if we were to look, so that, does that get at, Renee, what you were asking?
Yeah, and there is something about what you were saying earlier about the emotions do live kind of in the body, the sensations, and you can drop into that aspect of maybe form, maybe it lives in the
body.
So,
yeah. Okay. Okay. Please.
I had a very pleasant experience. I had waves of purple light coming.
Mm.
And it happens to me many times when I'm sitting all day meditation. Mm. And it really feels great. I don't have a name for it. It's like something, experience which is out of the names that we give usually.
Yeah.
I tried this time and I came to love compassion, but it's not necessary.
Yeah.
But it feels really, I feel like I'm based in something really, really, really good. I don't want it to go, and I know it's going to go. Because it comes in waves and it stays for a while. And
so it's very, very quiet and very kind of warm energy.
Yeah.
And connected with compassion.
Sorry?
Connected with compassion?
This time I thought it's love and compassion.
Yeah.
So I could see that I don't want it to go away in the exercise that we're doing here.
Yeah.
You know, I had some sense of humor about my wanting it to stay.
Yeah.
But I still said that I would love it to stay.
Yeah. So just notice in our practice that would be sort of part of the thick self, not too thick, but that wanting, the liking, that would be something we look for to be the thick self. Again, it's not so much go away thick self, not like that. It's more just to notice it. and you know, if it stays, that's okay. Yeah. Okay, I think I want to do, why don't we just sit for a few minutes now? We'll have lunch in just a little while, and what I found is that in U.S. we have lunch earlier than in Israel. Is 12:30 very early for lunch for people? Huh?
It's different.
It's changing.
It's changing.
It's becoming so.
Okay, because that might be like when we have retreats in U.S. That would be normal.
Yeah. No, in retreats.
Retreat. So you have U.S. lunch. And
the breakfast is different here. Dinner is different.
Okay. Yeah. Because I notice people say, okay, let's have lunch. They say, 2 o'clock.
It's the main meal many times. It's not just a sandwich.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just sit for a while. Then we'll have lunch. And I'd like to invite you to keep this same practice going during lunch, okay? In other words, during lunch, we can be with the flow of tastes. Notice where you have any thick self occurring. Like, oh, I like this. Oh, I should get some of this at home. Right, or if you just go into your own thinking, right? So. Again, stay with the flow of experience, number one. That's our two teachings for not self. We did some in the morning on not self, I think, and you're getting a sense of it. It was the first, just be with the flow of experience more and more, and then secondly, see where a thick sense of self or a big sense of self appears. It could be in reactivity, can be in self-image, can be in self-centered thinking, can be in a sense of I like this, I don't like this. We just notice that and then we come back to the flow. So that will be the invitation for lunch, and we'll come back at 1:30, about 1 hour, so you can take naps. 1:30 we'll come back with more Qigong. And I've also, I left out the sequence of Qigong, put it out there. And I'm going to have it emailed to everyone. Okay? Okay, so let's just sit, and I think I wanted to add one piece here just for maybe 5 minutes. Which is, in your own way, bring a sense of compassion or kindness to yourself. Because in some ways, looking at these three phenomena, impermanence and reactivity or dukkha, and anatta or not self, can be a lot. It's partly to look at identity. And we need to hold everything with a sense of warmth and kindness and compassion. Again, it's like I was saying yesterday, there's always the balance of wisdom and compassion. And what we've been looking at this weekend is more on the wisdom side. So we really need to have some balance with the compassion side, or the heart side. So just in your own way, if you know loving kindness, you can do just a few minutes of that, or if you know a compassion practice. And if you don't know any particular practice, just to maybe think of someone whom you love and bring that person to mind, and just feel your own sense of warmth and friendliness and love. Thank you. So thank you for the warning, and I'll just say that again, if you're interested in continuing maybe for a few weeks or a few months with the practices we're doing around impermanence and reactivity and not-self, and seeing more of those, I think it's helpful to have every day at least 10 minutes maybe more of a heart practice, like so you can balance the wisdom and compassion. Could be loving kindness practice. How many, most of you know that, right? How many of you know a loving kindness practice? And how many of you know some other, what I call heart practice, like compassion, something like that? And how many are not so much background in the loving kindness practice or heart practice? Okay, so it's... maybe I can... Maybe I'll teach it a little bit later. That might be good for... Because again, the whole, you know, we're having a large emphasis on wisdom practices. That's wonderful, but it's sometimes you can see if you study the thick self over and over again, sometimes you feel, oh my gosh, look at that thick self, right? And it can, mm-hmm. we need to hold it with compassion mm-hmm. and kindness. That's very important. And so I think I think generally it's good to have a wisdom practice and a heart practice all the time, right? And heart practice can be different. You know, we teach can be practice of compassion, loving kindness, joy, sometimes gratitude, forgiveness, equanimity, self-compassion, many different practices. So just to find one of them and do it 10 minutes a day, it goes a long way. So I'll do a little bit more of that in the afternoon. Yeah. I was going to do that yesterday and some today, but you had so many questions. So we'll do it later. Okay. So we have lunch now. And again, continue with the practice. Continue with the practice of the same one that we just did in the meditation, okay? In your eating, be with the flow, watch where something else comes up that is about thick self. Okay? Good. So we'll come back.